Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, Game Wisdom's owner and lead writer. And joining me this week, my co-host and artist for Smugbeat Games, Kenneth Ohm.
Hey there.
And from Clay Entertainment, developer Kevin Forbes.
Hi.
It's great to have you on, Kevin.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
All right. We've talked about Clay Entertainment in the past. We've had an email interview with you about Don't Starve. We talked about Mark of the Ninja. But for the people who aren't too familiar with Clay, could you tell us a little bit about how Clay Entertainment started and what type of games you guys generally like to make?
Sure, yeah. I think I actually haven't been here the entire time the company has been here.
Okay.
I've been a couple years in. I believe the company started around 2005 or so. Jamie Cheng, our CEO, founded it with some other people who are still around, actually. And they made a game called Eats. It was kind of a physics-y puzzle game. It was pretty cute. I think it was one of the early games on Steam. And they did that. And then they did, I believe, an Xbox version of that. And then they started working on a free-to-play game, kind of a Smash Brothers thing called Sugar Rush, for Nexon. And that's when I joined the company, in 2008 or so. And that actually never saw the light of day. It almost did. It was about a week away from launch when the parent company shut down, the branch that we were working with shut down.
Yeah, isn't that the name of the world from Wreck-It Ralph? Sugar Rush?
It is. Yeah, it has nothing to do with that, as far as I know, because it was kind of a Smash Brothers kind of thing with customizable characters, and they beat each other over the head with fish and whatnot. So there's no driving or anything like that. But I don't think we had any say in the movie, at least I know of. But yeah, kind of from the ashes of that, we made Shank 1, and then that did pretty well. We made a sequel to Shank called Shank 2. Mark of the Ninja happened pretty recently. I wasn't actually directly involved with Mark of the Ninja, but I saw it being built. I really like that game. and kind of in parallel with the second half of Mark of the Ninja, kind of a lot of the Shank 2 team transitioned into Don't Starve, which just came out about a couple weeks ago, and we are continuing to update for the foreseeable future, or at least 6 months.
Now, is Don't Starve your first official project you worked on at Clay?
As a developer? No, I worked a little bit on Sugar Rush, and okay. I was one of the programmers on Shank 1 and Shank 2.
Cool. All right. We did an analysis of Don't Starve a few weeks ago. How has the reception been for it for you guys?
It's been pretty great. Our sales have been pretty good, kind of beyond expectation. Which is nice, having kind of struggled a bit in the past, back in the Shank days and whatnot. The critical reception has been mixed, which is kind of what we were expecting. I think Metacritic right now has that about a 76. It is a hard game to review, I think, because it kind of thumbs its nose at a lot of modern gaming conventions, which I think critics are kind of complicent in creating. So there's no tutorial. It doesn't care if you don't understand it. It wants you to come to it. And I could see that being, if you had to review the game on a deadline and you're being forced to play and it wasn't kind of gelling with you, I could see that being very frustrating. So there's a couple, there's some 60s and whatnot on the Metacritic. But those who like it tend to really like it. So if I could have my wish, I think it would kind of go up to an 80 on Metacritic, but I don't know if that's actually going to happen. I think it's that things move around a lot when Metacritic scores start rolling in, and then they kind of stabilize and then go down over time, if anything, because people want to prove a point. But we probably shouldn't worry so much about Metacritic scores. We have the highest score on Metacritic of any game right now, which is pretty awesome, but not critical.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the reviews. I remember some people on the Clay forums were talking about how some guys deeming found there was an adventure mode in the game, which is just crazy.
Yeah, well, you see, we made a choice, and we have to live with it now, that adventure mode is hidden. It's kind of an odd choice, I guess, but it's one I believe in, in that I think in order for a game to kind of have a mystique about it and to be mysterious and to feel like there's a lot more to it than what it kind of just presents on the surface, you have to have stuff that not everybody sees. In our case, it's like half the game, which is kind of odd. We actually made it a little bit easier to find the door to adventure mode. It's a physical door in the game if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Post-launch, because we've issued a couple of small like hot fixes over the past 2 weeks. Now you can build a divining rod, which was an object that you could use in adventure mode to kind of find your progression throughout it. You can build that in sandbox, and it will kind of point you in the direction of the door. You're not just scouring the map, but it's still not like accessible from the menu or anything like that.
And that actually takes you to the first thing I want to talk about was Avenger mode, since that was one like the first, like that was like one of the really big additions between beta to develop to full retail. With Avenger mode, for those of you listening who haven't played it, from what I was seeing, it's basically you have to survive 5 theme worlds of Don't Starve, each one having basically a different situation. One was, you know, winter all the time. I got one that was like, you had to basically explore different islands. Now, for you guys, how did you decide, like, what 5 themes to base the adventure mode around?
It was really based upon what mechanics we could highlight in each theme. So something really important in Don't Starve is the sanity mechanics. So the island-themed world actually kind of forces you to deal with that because you're having to go through wormholes all the time, which slowly saps your sanity, and that kind of brings that to the fore. There's a winter-themed one. There's a darkness-themed one. It was basically we had at the point where we were actually coming up with the levels. I wrote a story first, and we attempted to build those story levels, but they didn't really work that well. This is about a month before launch, or a month and a half before launch, and then kind of from that, we kept all the writing bits, but then the actual, like, and then Wilson goes here, and then Wilson goes there kind of stuff got replaced with levels that actually highlighted mechanics that we deemed would be interesting to explore. So that... That was kind of a big gamble at the end there, but it mostly paid off, I think.
Now, Adventure Mode is one of the elements of the game that is definitely made for more like the higher difficulty. And I know when I interviewed you a few months ago, that was one of the challenges you talked about in trying to bounce between this game being appealing and easy to learn versus, you know, the hardcore, you know, when winter comes, you know, you're not prepared, you basically die of hypothermia in like a few days. How has it been, you know, trying to, you know, straddle that line between making it simple to play versus the hardcore side of Don't Starve?
It's been one of the bigger challenges that we've had. We've gone back and forth with our very outspoken, in a good way, forum community. They have little battles all the time about things are too hard or things are too easy. This is OP, this is UP, on and on and on. And we kind of sit back and watch for the most part, and try not to intervene because they work these things out themselves and it's fascinating to watch and you can get a lot of design feedback from that. And kind of from the sum total of that going on for several months, we came up with a difficulty curve that we believe introduces people to the game slow enough that, it remains interesting. But that like, You're meant to die a lot in the beginning. You die like the first day, and then you die the second day, and then you die the fourth day. But every time you learn a little more and you survive a little longer. So that's kind of like the for early game players introduction part of the game. And then adventure mode is we kind of just pull the stops out and we say, yeah, we're gonna kill you. Pretty much, you're gonna just die. And if you are persistent enough and lucky enough, because there are a lot of random elements. And you've learned enough about Don't Starve in the main game, then you'll be able to, you know, slowly progress and make your way through Adventure World a little farther each time until you actually reach the end. And then the death mechanic is actually different in Adventure Mode for that reason. You actually don't, we don't, I mean, we're usually permadeath, wipe your save game, game over kind of game, but in Adventure Mode, because it's so hard, and it took you quite a while to find the door, we just kind of boot you to the start. So, like, you die in Adventure Mode, you wake up back in your sandbox and you can try again right away if you feel like it. which again was a conscious decision to, because it would have been way too hardcore if we actually, permadeathed you in there, in the area that's super hard. But yeah, I think like, the way that, the game has progressed is that, sandbox mode has probably been, it's been getting a bit easier over time, because it's sandbox mode. Like you can kind of just fart around in there as long as you want. But then nowadays we kind of view that as a hub world, and like you veer off from the, you learn how to play the game in there. It's still deadly and, you know, it's still permadeath, but, you learn to play the game in there. And with that knowledge, you then take that to other places like adventure mode or like the caves, which we're working on currently, where the actual kind of late game, mid to late game challenge actually lies.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the things I noticed when I was playing, that once I got good enough at sandbox mode or survival mode, it did get somewhat easy to just stay around. I think my current record, I think I lasted, I think about 27 days of playing, and that was just me at the end. I was just like, I just want to, you know, unlock a few more characters. Let me just, you know, end it right here kind of deal.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, that's kind of a, like, with an open world kind of sandboxy game, you run into that problem in that, like, eventually the player will hit the end of the content. But by day 27, that's, like, the end of the first winter, I think.
Yeah, I was some, pretty some sure close to it.
Close to the end of the first winter, around there. You've seen a lot of what the game has to offer probably by that point, at least in isolation. But, I mean, you've seen a piecemeal and arranged a certain way, so you'll probably still be very challenged if you go into adventure mode from there, because stuff comes at you in surprising combinations and that kind of thing. And there are a lot of, like, elements of the game, like, things that you can find and areas that we've kind of pre-hand built, that you only see in adventure mode. So, yeah. Without, like, a crazy creative element like Minecraft, which isn't really supported by the way our game looks and renders and that you interact with, like, it is very hard to maintain kind of an open-ended survival challenge, which is why we're branching off into these hub worlds where it's a little more direct.
Yeah. I would say for me, there's still, I think, a lot that I haven't seen yet. I haven't really had a chance to really fill in with Papyrus, and I saw that you guys had, like, Clockwork Enemies and the Pigman King. And I still haven't found those guys, because once I find, like, a place, like, pretty situated, I just basically, you know, build my own little town right there.
Yeah,
and try to survive.
Yeah, you definitely, if you don't travel around your map, you will miss out on certain things that aren't everywhere.
Let's see. Kent, do you have any questions you want to talk about in terms of, like, art and design?
Oh, yeah, so how did you start with this art style that you have now? What was the origins of it? Was it influenced by Tim Burton or, German Expressionism?
Yeah. you've read previous interviews.
Well, it definitely looks that way.
Yeah, so it's, I think, like, the very origins of the game, it came from a game jam that me and another programmer had made. And in that game, it was all stolen from the internet assets, like most game jams are. I think the main character was actually like SNES era Link, because that was the sprite sheet that we found when we typed in sprite sheet. And it had a nice turnaround. And the enemies were this weird little sprite of a person in a pig suit, I believe. Not a pig and not a person, but a pig person. And we did that, and there was a day and night cycle, and they kind of came and went and whatever. And like, mechanically, there was kind of the beginnings of what Don't Starve actually became in there, but it was a 24-hour game jam, so not too terribly deep. So when we decided to expand that out into a full game, obviously, I mean, the art style was programmer art, stolen from the internet programmer art, the worst kind. So we needed to actually come up with kind of a marketing angle and how we wanted the story to progress and what kind of feelings we wanted to show with the game. And we talked about this a lot, over dinner meetings and whatnot with the creative director. And eventually, we decided to go with kind of an emo gothy kind of thing, which Tim Burton is a big influence upon that. German Expressionism, as you said, like a lot of old movies like Nosferatu and Phantom of the Opera from like the 20s, like there's really crazy, like light and dark, like heavy shadows and distorted shapes. And I think Tim Burton gets a lot of influence from those films. And then also, like Edward Gorey, like the Gashly Crumb, sorry, the Gashly Crumb Tinies, got passed around the office quite a bit. We're looking at that, Charles Adams, that kind of thing. So like it was kind of just a big melting pot of kind of, hot topic kind of things that went into this look. And then, you know, just with a little, if you look at some of the way the plants are and whatnot, there's a lot of Dr. Seuss in there as well. So it's just kind of a whimsical, but dark, but not taking itself all too serious, art direction, with just a splash of Cthulhu mythos.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of mystery to the style too. I think it's very striking. I think that's what draws people's eyes immediately when they see Don't Starve, is that it has that look you don't really see in many other games. It's definitely risky.
Yeah, I think, well, that's what I like about it, is that it, like, if you see a Don't Starve screenshot, it's not confusing as to what you're looking at. It's Don't Starve. There's not a lot of games that actually have that look to it. And I mean, a lot of the actual, like, the nitty gritties of how the animations work and how many views you get of things, a lot of those come down to, we were building this game in the beginning on the very cheap, like with a very small team with a very constrained budget. But we had this kind of grandiose, like, we want this open world with all this stuff in it and all these characters, and we're going to scale the game out, like, based on the number of characters and add more things over time. We had to pick an art style which was economical, in terms of production costs. But at the same time, held up, like, our studio kind of has a reputation for animation quality and that, because all of our artists are, you know, they're from TV industry animation and that kind of thing. So they're all quite good at animating. But we wanted to do it kind of on the cheap, but, at the same time, have it look really good. So there are a lot of compromises and whatnot, which I think worked in our favor in the long term, in terms of the game's actual look and how it doesn't look like a lot of other games.
Right, and it's always interesting to give an artist restraints because they have to work within certain limitations, and that's where true creativity arises, I would say.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like, Wilson, like, he's got this one animation, like, because we don't like to animate Wilson doing new things very often, because if we did that whenever we wanted to, we'd have, like, you know, hundreds of megabytes of Wilson animation and nothing would ever get done. So he's kind of got this one animation that's kind of, he waves his hands in the air in, like, a figure eight, and that's his "I'm doing something" animation, and it's very hand wavy, literally. But it's also, it's a perfect metaphor for the art style, because he's like, whoa, 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 hey, I just built a whatever. And it kind of works, given the views that we have.
No, I definitely like that combination of, you know, intricacy, because he's building something complex, but he's also doing something very simple in terms of the action. But, you know, it's good feedback for the user.
Yeah, and he's not a very good scientist either. He's a very high level.
he's trying to survive, you know, just what he can.
Necessity.
So, here's a question. So what made you decide to start selling the game, you know, during its beta mode? Like, what, because you're one of the first developers that, you know, or at least one of the front runners that are doing that.
Well, I think it was, we had to make the, we wanted to make the game self-sustaining as quick as possible so that we could develop it without worrying about running out of money developing it. And at the same time, we were a very small team, especially at that time. We grew near the end of production, and we're still larger than we were at this time. But in the early days, it was only, like, you know, three programmers and an artist working on the game. So we needed feedback from the community. Like, we were implementing stuff as quick as we could across two platforms at the time, Chrome, which is a very strange platform, and an actual Windows build that eventually launched on Steam. So we needed to get, like, the game out in front of people on all sorts of crazy computers to get the compatibility issues out of the way and all that stuff. And so it just made sense to put it online, and get it into people's hands as quick as possible to get that feedback and incorporate it and build the game that people would actually want to play, which you really can't do, unless you have a lot of time and luxury in your production to iterate yourself. Or you can, you know, put it out and get people's immediate feedback. And then once it was online, I mean, if people will pay for it, that's great. It also means that, they're a little more invested in the process as well. Because if you just get someone a free game and you say, oh, give me feedback, they'll give you feedback or whatever, or they'll just leave. But, you know, if you present something which is visually interesting, and makes them want to play, and you tell them up front, this is a work in progress. We're not done yet. We need your help to finish this. It's going to take us about, I think at the time, probably about 8 months to finish. And you're honest about that, and it's truthful, and it actually comes out when you said it was going to come out thereabouts. then I think that, you know, they give you, I think at the time we were selling, like, you got like 4 keys for $7 when we first started selling it. It was pretty generous. People will pay the money gladly and be invested and stick around for a long time and help you, you know, build this frankly kind of crappy, like, early version of the game into something that's more presentable.
Yeah, I was one of the early adopters of the game, just on the art style alone.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I was telling everyone about it too, and I was like taken aback by putting it on Chrome. I was like, Chrome? It's just like you and Bastion are the only games that I know are in Chrome.
Yeah, it's an interesting platform. Like, it let us get the game out to people really easily, right? Like, because we weren't on Steam there, and the Steam Early Access Program didn't exist at that point. It kind of came into existence about a month or two before we actually launched, and we were in there for just the end of it. So, like, kind of the conventional reasoning was that you couldn't stay on Steam in an open beta for longer than a couple of months or whatever. So in order to have the extra time, in order to get into people's hands, we chose Chrome. Oh. It's a neat piece of technology. Although it's very different, like on a technical level, it kind of broke all of our minds to work in like the web world. Cause mm-hmm. you know, we're all like from AAA console development originally, very different mindset and very different technology. So it was a bit of a learning experience for us.
Yeah. So with, at least with Chrome, what do you take from it for other developers working with Chrome, or they want to develop for it? What would you tell them?
I'd say that get someone on your team who's familiar with that stuff. That stuff being like JavaScript, general like web CSS stuff. Like we all kind of know it, but not very well. So in the early days, there was a lot of breakage and confusion and cursing at jQuery and stuff like that.
I gotcha.
Yeah, I have friends who are web professional web developers, and they would, you know, I'd tell them all this, and they just kind of shake their head and sigh. Like, oh, you'll learn, don't worry. I never did. So once we kind of got it working, we're like, never touch it again. And then we would just work, like, you know, in the actual game itself, in the engine itself that we were building up from the ground up, and we're very familiar with and could iterate very quickly upon. But, oh God, don't ask me to change the JavaScript right now.
Yeah, and oh yeah, and to going back and talking about selling it during beta, you actually got a lot of good publicity because there's a lot of really bad betas. Like, there's what's called Villages that came out on Steam. What was it called? Towns. Yeah, Towns and War Z. They both didn't tell the people buying it that was alpha or beta. So there was a lot of people got really angry. But you guys clearly put it right up front, saying like, we're in beta, you're buying a beta. So people use you guys a lot as reference, as you know, the way you should do it. So
yeah, I think it just comes down to honesty, really. I mean, like, if you're honest with people and you don't hide behind a layer of like corporate bullshit, and it doesn't seem like you're trying to pull a fast one on them, I think that they're willing to accept quite a lot. Like, during the beta, I erased people's save games by accident, and it was kind of like, sorry guys, it's a real beta. It's not like a fake beta where we're just pretending. Actual bugs that we're actually putting in the game all the time. Everyone always grumbles about that, and rightly so. But I mean, people accepted that as like, okay, well, growing pains, and we continue along. I mean, I think, yeah, you have a point with. I actually haven't played Towns. I've seen the screenshots and thought, oh, that looks like Minecraft. I like Minecraft, or not Dwarf Fortress. But I think that a lot of Greenlight games came out too early for their own good. It's kind of like you'd have a game that was in a very early state, like Don't Starve was at the same time, and you know, the community would get behind it and get really excited about this game, and it's going to, you know, cure cancer and be the best thing ever, and it would get greenlit, and then just on the front page of Steam, when it, you know, was beta quality at best software, and it was not represented as such. And yeah, people were kind of rightfully angry about a lot of that. Although War Z, I think, is a separate special case.
Oh yeah, well, that's where PR could have done a lot of good, but they're all like, "Oh, let's let the creator to talk," and then he was all like, "It's a foundation build, you know."
Yeah,
and using... the game's never really done.
Yeah, great. He really shot himself in the foot because he's having the same issue of everyone hating on him specifically, and then hating on the game, just adding on top of it.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you come at the community in a spirit of opposition, I think you've already lost.
Right. I mean, I think it's a good time to fess up, you know, it's like, we made a mistake, we're sorry, we were in beta or alpha, so give us some time. But instead of said, he was like, you're all, you gave us your money. We don't care. I was like, oh.
Yeah, and gamers are pretty easily angered about such things, so you should be careful.
Yeah. Going back to what you were saying a few minutes ago about like how indie developers had that layer of transparency with development and fixing things, I think that's definitely something that we're seeing becoming more and more important as AAA developers are having problems and we're seeing more games being knocked because of problems like that. Like the whole like last month and month before that with SimCity 5, it just seems that developers are more and more shooting themselves in the foot with, you know, hiding behind closed doors and, you know, they're saying something and then, you know, a week later they're changing their minds. And I think the general consumers are becoming a little bit more intelligent in that regard and aren't going to be fooled by that BS for much longer.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, like a lot of, like SimCity in particular, if something is coming from a large company, like you're not actually ever talking to the developers probably. You're talking to like the PR director or the troubleshooter or someone who's, you know, isn't directly involved in development and probably the people actually involved in development weren't actually involved in decisions which led to the problems in development because there's multiple layers of middle managers and upper managers and all this stuff going on. And really no one can talk to the game for that point at that point because there's just so many people involved and so many vested interests to represent. I mean, with us, it's a very small team. I think the company is larger than the team, but like the team working on Don't Starve at its largest was about a dozen people. And like, you know, they put me in front of people for interviews. I'm a programmer. You know, I'm probably going to finish this and then go back to my desk and hook up stalagmites or something for the caves. So like, you can ask me about the game and I'll tell you, you know, what it's like to work on it, which is not something that you would get, from EA. In fact, like when you work in AAA, because I come from AAA originally, you can't talk about your game at all. Like on pain of losing your job, if you mention anything anywhere on the internet at all, you don't talk. That's the culture of AAA development.
Well, it makes sense too, because if they make a statement and then you say something to differ it, you know, you're going to be in huge trouble.
Yeah,
and I think with at least SimCity 5, they said a lot of really, really bad cover-ups, and then they underestimated their fans, and
mumble cloud processing, mumble.
yeah, and you know the things like it has to be single player, right?
Yeah.
Sorry about the noise, but yeah, so they said it has to be single player, but someone hacked into it, and within like a couple hours, he got it working without having to be online.
Yeah.
So that's a clear example of. You know, PR making a pretty big mistake.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not even that the PR was lying. They probably actually believed that, but they weren't involved in the development itself. So, I mean, if your job is just to talk to people all day but not to actually do things, then you're probably not always talking about things you actually know, I think.
Yeah, I remember the whole, like, city size argument. Like, a week before, they said, oh, we're testing it right now. We're going to allow you to make cities bigger. And then 2 weeks later, they said, oh, no, you can't do that. And then another week or so later, the person said, why would you want to make your cities bigger? Why can't you just enjoy the game for what it is? And the whole time, my head is just, I'm just in facepalm mode reading that.
Again, I think it's really important nowadays for the developers or the teams, you know, to have a certain face with their game. Because so many games that come out, especially for independents, that you need to have, you know, good, PR with the game that you've created. Because you come out as, you know, an arrogant person or you're saying something that's very insulting to your base, they can easily turn and play another game.
Right.
There's a lot of, like, indie game in the movie, you know, that Phil Fish character. Even though his game's amazing, he came off a bit pretentious in that movie, and so there's a lot of backlash. And then, you know, when he started to communicate with his fans, then we had, you know, more of that kind of tension, but he didn't back down, so now he's a very, very polarizing person within the field.
Right. Yeah, I think it's like, you know, like there's a couple of people here at Clay that have experience with, like, you know, proper PR and how to community management and that kind of thing. And, you know, like if you just kind of jump into that and you're just talking to, you know, thousands of people as if you're talking to one person or whatever, and you're like, you know, screw you, I don't think that's right. That's not going to go well for you. So I mean, I'm lucky in that, like, you know, when I first was unleashed upon, you know, the Don't Starve community, and like, you know, as somewhat of the public face of the thing, and talking to people and whatnot, like, I've misstepped. I've been rude once or twice, by accident, but there's always been someone here to support me to kind of rein in and say, well, Kevin, you know, maybe, type what you're going to say first and then read it out loud and then, you know, think about how that could be misconstrued and then type it again, you know, just stuff like that. Like, not formal training or anything like that, but just like, you know, come at things with a bit of a sense of humility. And, you know, even if you win an argument online about the video game, if you alienate that person that you're disagreeing with, or you make them angry, or you look like a jerk, to other people, then you've really lost, because those are potential customers you're alienating. Those are people who would otherwise like your game and go out and tell other people about it, and you'd have more people enjoying your work if you were not a jerk. So yeah, I mean, like, I think it's, if you have a very small team where it's like one person and what he says goes, and that's kind of it, you can get into those situations where, you know, a little too much honesty, perhaps. Well, not honesty, just too much frankness, I guess. Like,
yeah, I mean, I think him and the War Z guy both had the same thing with, you guys already paid the money, deal with it. I'm like, whoa, that's not the way you should handle it.
Yeah, I mean, like, say that out loud to your friends and then type something polite in. You know?
Exactly.
Being diplomatic is very important these days.
And also, I have one last question about the art for the game. And this is actually something dear to my heart, because the major game that I play is Team Fortress 2.
Okay. Yep.
So you guys actually released Team Fortress 2 hats.
We did, yeah.
And there was another company, Lab Zero, who made Skullgirls, and I actually donated to their Kickstarter campaign. Well, actually, it was Indiegogo. Anyways, but the point is, you know, they announced that they were, for certain tiers, they would get TF2 hats based on a certain character, like as a cool tentacle hat, and they had all the concept art and everything ready, and they were going to announce it, and then suddenly it got completely rejected by Steam. So they had to make a big announcement to all the backers and say, hey, no TF2 hats, maybe something in the future. They said their reason was that they were really busy, the team at Valve was really busy, and they couldn't put the hat in. How did you actually start that chain of communication with the team at Valve?
Well, I wasn't involved directly in talking to them about that. I know that we do have a pretty good relationship with them, and you know, we talk back and forth about such things. I think that I wasn't aware that Skullgirls actually did that, but it sounds like they promised something externally that they weren't 100% sure that they could fulfill.
Exactly.
And I think that's very, very dangerous whenever you do that. Like, you know, there are things that I really can't talk about yet about Don't Starve, because we're not 100% sure we're going to do them, and I wouldn't want someone to look forward to it and then be disappointed about it. So I think we didn't really talk about the hats until the hats were a done deal, and were ready and accepted and ready to go, and then it was like, oh yeah, we have hats. Check out the hats. And that did well for us, because people love those hats. I mean, like, we had hats that were rejected as well. Like, there was the one I really liked was like, it was like a pig head that would kind of wrap around your characters.
Oh my god.
I know.
Why not?
It must have been too cool or something. Because Valve was at it not from like trying to optimize every individual hat, but they're looking at the overall hat ecosystem, right? So like, they have to kind of pace themselves, I guess, or whatever. It's their game, not ours. So they get to call the shots hat-wise. We're just lucky to get a hat in.
Oh, man. Well, you got two things. And you got the main character's hair, and you also got a ham weapon.
Yep.
Which does base damage. So, yeah, it's very interesting. I'm just really sad that the pig hat didn't make it in, because that would have been really unique. You don't really see many pig hats in
TF2. There was a spider hat, too, yeah. There was some cool concept art.
You're making a lot of TF2 players cry right now.
Email Valve, get him to let us put the pig hat in.
Yeah, too bad you can't, like, keep adding hats and be like, hey, more, you know, or how about maybe putting a sale together with more hats? I think that would...
Right.
Even pushed your sales to record highs for at least TF2 players.
Yeah, I think we've probably exceeded our hat goodwill for the game. I think they have to. The reason those hats are so special is that Valve rations them out to only a couple games at a time, and that whole. I mean, the whole hat thing was a revelation to me because I played TF2 before it was free to play and there weren't hats, and I was like, oh yeah, cool game, whatever. But then some of the other team members were like, oh my god, we have a Team Fortress hat coming. I'm like, what? And then I went down the rabbit hole of like the hat economy, and it was mind blowing.
It gets like pretty crazy. I'm the same way. I started playing Team Fortress 2, I think 07 or 08 when I first started, and there was like no hats. They're just starting with the whole concept of items, and then year after year, free to play, the hat economy, the store, and all that craziness. And it's just like, what the hell happened here? I don't remember all this stuff.
Awesome happened, all right?
You can be like a virtual haberdasher and sell like $100 cats. I really like it, but it's weird.
All right, going back to something we were talking about a few minutes ago regarding the selling multiple keys for the Don't Starve beta, what was the decision that when it was officially put on Steam to sell it, you buy one key, you get a key for a friend? Because traditionally, we usually see that for like multiplayer games, like Monaco that just came out, Sanctum, and those.
Mm-hmm.
What was? Yeah.
Purely a word of mouth thing. I mean, that's what's driven our sales for like word of mouth, digital word of mouth, where people put like YouTube videos up and Twitch streams and that kind of thing. So like our goal in the early stages of actually getting the game out, was to get it into as many people's hands as possible. So the idea was that you would get a game, you would get the game, if you liked it, you had this extra key, which you could then give to a friend who would then like it and maybe buy a copy for his friend or tell his friend who would then buy a copy and that kind of thing. So it was purely just a 2-for-1, hey, this is game so fun, show your friends kind of thing.
I guess one last question I have regarding the art design. With the game, there's definitely been a wide variety of characters in it. Do you have a favorite character, either enemy or playable?
Well, playable, I'm partial to Wilson, just because he's kind of the heart and soul of the game. And he has that introduction cartoon, which is on YouTube. In terms of, like, characters in the game, I think the Beefalo have a special place in my heart, just because they look so sad when you take their hair away.
Yeah. It's like, oh.
Yeah, he's not hurting or anything. His pride is hurting, you know?
my favorite, just in terms of sheer, like, what the hell was that, was the tree guard guy. Because I just saw him, like, when I first did Adventure Mode, the winter level, I'm just, like, cutting trees down. Like, this is fun. And all of a sudden, I see this, like, thing coming out of the forest. Like, what the hell is that? And it starts, like, punching me. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, we're not above a jump scare or two. there's a couple of things that kind of do that to you. The gobbler, I don't know if you've seen the gobbler. You pick a lot of berries and you'll see the gobbler. And he's not dangerous, he's just an asshole.
With the tree guard, I have a funny story that happened like during my longest game where he showed up like 2 days in. I was like, that was surprising. And then I like put down the seedlings to sort of make him happy, but the thing is, he stayed right at my camp. So for like 4 days, he was basically my roommate who like popped out whenever there was trouble to like beat everything up. Like, all right, this is cool. But then like on the fifth day, I ran out of logs to build a fire. Like, oh, I gotta cut down a tree, and then of course that pissed him off again.
It's like, no, you didn't, right? Yeah.
Like, dude, stay cool. We're supposed to be friends.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, actually, my shortest game was my first game, and when I first loaded that game, at least in Don't Starve, I just hit everything with my axe. I just hit everything I could, and the third thing I hit was just a spider nest. I didn't know what I expected.
Well, in real life, if you hit a big spider nest, spiders are going to come out, right? So it's definitely a bit of an educational process when you start playing Don't Starve, because like you have a weapon and you can clip things by clicking on them, and video game logic, your inclination is, I'm going to hit everything and kill the world. But we really didn't want that to be the result of doing that, so it corrects your behavior.
Yeah, I remember I was casting with Josh at the time, and then I was like, oh god, spiders. And then that was pretty much my experience. And I was like, this is definitely an interesting game of survival after that, so.
Yeah, I did like the same education when I first started playing. Before I got to my big 27-day survival spree, it was pretty much me dying like day two, day three, just like running, going, what happens when I hit this with a spear? Oh, he's pissed at me now. Or, let me go near that giant bird with his nest. He won't do anything angry at me.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about Don't Starve is that experimentation, right? Because you don't hold anyone's hand. You just go ahead and do this, or go ahead and try this. And I think that's why a lot of people are, attaching themselves to the game.
Yeah, imagine your first encounter with that spider nest. If you walked up to it and, you got like the typical AAA console game, bloop, this is a spider nest. If you hit it, spiders will come up, blah, blah, blah. Do the next thing to continue the tutorial. And you go and hit it, and then, it pauses the game again, and the spider's attacking you, and it explains all the controls and all. Like, it takes you straight out of the game, in my opinion.
Well, and I think it adds a layer of mystery, too. Like, what else could kill me terribly? What happens if I hit this tree? Will this tree come alive and kill me? So, it adds, like, a layer of fear and anxiety that's definitely needed in a game called Don't Starve.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say the only thing that was just a little bit too confusing when I absolutely first started playing, this was way back in the beta, was the whole charcoal thing. Because I didn't realize you could actually set things on fire with a torch. I was just like, randomly, wait, we can do that? Let me try that in this giant forest. and then there was like the difference between charcoal and then just making ash that I didn't realize first. And then that becomes really important later on when you try and build, the crock pot and a lot of like the better healing items.
Yeah, I think that a lot of that comes down to, especially if you're playing in the really early beta, is that the interface has evolved and continues to evolve. Like, I think previously, if you wanted to burn down the tree, you had to actually pick up the torch in your inventory and hover it over and click on it. It's really kind of non-intuitive and not like other things in the game. Whereas now, I believe if you have the torch equipped, you just hover over and there's a little picture of a right mouse button. And it's like, oh, I can right mouse button, like, light this thing on fire, which is a lot more discoverable. So I think that's a little better, at least now.
Yeah. All right. Going back to some design questions I have about Don't Starve. As we talked about, between beta and retail, you guys add in a lot of major stuff. What was, I guess, like the most demanding or the most complicated that was added to the game?
Definitely adventure mode. I mean, like, all the other major additions. Like, early in beta, we made a roadmap, which was a list of, I think at the time, about four major features which needed to be in the game to cause the game to be completed, in our opinion. So it was like winter and sanity and adventure mode, and there was some other stuff. I forget what it is now. But all of those things, except for adventure mode, were more or less completed in one update. Well, like one update for the art and whatnot, and then one update to actually hook it all up. So that kind of scope. Adventure mode took like three updates and a large portion of the team working in close concert with the community, because we were actually at the very end of development putting up builds like every other day that you could opt in to play, which were kind of buggy, kind of crashy, like nightly build kind of stuff, but that were tuned, that were being tuned with feedback in that tight of a loop. So it was really a big, like, both team and community effort to get that out and polished into the state that it was in for the time that it had to be done in.
I guess with sanity, one thing I just want to ask you about is, how did you go about developing the sanity mechanic? Because it became a very interesting mechanic of how in the early game it's more of a detriment to the player. Before the players who are going for the late game, the higher crafting, it almost becomes a necessity to go insane to get that.
Well, I think it's that really comes from the thematic elements of it. Like, I really wanted a Lovecraftian model of sanity, right? Where it's like there's a true nature of the universe that's kind of lurking just beyond our perception, and the more you learn about it, the crazier you get, the more you learn about it, blah, blah, blah. So you get into this cycle where, I can see the truth, the shadow creatures are coming. And you gain power from that. Like, you can get nightmare fuel, you can unlock a whole bunch of crafting, you can wield terrible weapons and unholy armor and stuff like that. But again, that also makes you crazier, which causes the shadow creatures eventually to notice you and then attack you. But it was really inspired by Mythos. and it just kind of worked as a game mechanic.
Cool. With the winter mechanic, as you talk about, that was one like the major roadmaps of the game. I guess, do you see, like, I guess this is the part we may get into, like, the no comment territory. do you see, like, any more, like, major, like, events like winter in the future of Don't Starve?
So it's tricky, right? Like, now that we are launched, I'm a lot more hesitant to make radical changes to the main sandbox experience. Just because there's an expectation of continuity there for a lot of people. Like, I don't think that it would be well received by the fans if we were to introduce Sanity, if we didn't have Sanity yet and we introduced it now, because we'd be fundamentally changing the nature of the game. So there's a bit of a hesitation to cause anything like really big and crazy to happen there, which is part of the reason why we're kind of branching off in these hub worlds. So like caves, no one's been down in a cave yet and Don't Starve. And, you know, when it first goes in this next update, it'll probably be kind of beta-ish. And you know, stuff down there will be kind of, it'll be like the days of the beta down there, and we'll be changing stuff a lot and tuning stuff a lot. But it's stuff that is totally optional. Like, you don't have to go down there. So if you don't like it or you don't want to deal with, you know, anything that's not completely 100% polished, you can just stay up in, like, the main part of the game. So it's just a way of kind of segmenting. Early adopter type players can opt in to go down and look at that stuff, but if they don't want to mess with that, and a lot of people don't, they can play the game that they bought without interruption, hopefully, in the above world.
Yeah. All right. So regarding that with the future content, I know by the time this podcast actually airs, you guys will be doing your live stream of the Caves announcement. Mm-hmm. For as we talked about in the beginning, there's been that, I guess, push and pull between keeping the game more on the accessible side and then, you know, having just the straight up brutal stuff for the hardcore. Mm-hmm. For, I guess, for like what you're going to be developing in the future, where do you see, I guess, the content that's going to be coming going to be on that side? Is it going to be more for adding more stuff accessible or more to, like, reward the hardcore, more, you know, punishing late game kind of stuff?
I think it's going to be mostly the latter. If only the hardcore stuff. Because I think that the early game is pretty complete, as it is. Like, for a game of the scale of Don't Starve, like, if you buy it and you just play through that stuff without any of the stuff we're going to add, I mean, you've probably gotten your money's worth, and there's quite a few hours of entertainment to be had there. And it's also the result of like a year's worth of tuning in order to get like people up to that point. Like, you know, I can, you kind of learn about fire in a certain way, and then you learn about fighting and all that. And all that's been kind of tuned, and I don't want to upset that too much by adding like new stuff in the middle of it. I mean, we might add like little fun things, like, I don't know, balloon animals or something that you can build, that you can do there. But I think that, there is probably enough content to keep early players happy in the game already, but we do need more like late game, like crazy challenges and whatnot. If you want to sink 200 hours into Don't Starve, we need to add more like late game content for you to be able to do that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that I've heard a few people discussing about on the various forums is like the lack of like Steam achievements. Do you see anything like in that regard being added in the future, or will Don't Starve remain like mostly insular in terms of awards?
I think that like we've talked about that a lot, actually. That there was an article that Jamie and I wrote for Penny Arcade last year about, you know, balancing extrinsic and intrinsic rewards when you're trying to get someone to play a game. And, you know, like, the more I think about it, the less I like achievements. I think I was playing BioShock recently the new BioShock. And yeah, it's like, you know, you beat through like basically the tutorial, the hour or so of non-interactive walking and looking at stuff that they make you do before you play the actual game. And, you know, like at some point there's a fade to black and you're like, oh, finally I get to play. And you get an achievement, or in my case, a PS3 trophy or whatever, that pops up. And I'm like, really? I didn't earn that. That's stupid. with all the time you had to develop that game, that's what you came up with.
I assume that they do that too, just also in terms of just getting to know other people that you're playing Bioshock or you're playing a certain game, and then they themselves would be interested or interested in talking to you about the game. I think that's
part of
the benefit of it.
I've never looked at a friend's achievements before, ever.
You don't stalk your friend's Steam profiles?
Oh, you got more gamer score than I got. I think that, like, for me, like I've read a lot of commentary online about Don't Starve, and you know, people say this game needs achievements, and it needs, like, a lot of reviews even say that, you know, like, we need more, you need to get more from playing the game, you know, as you progress, because they take away your save game. Like, you know, you need to earn something. I'm like, well, what do you earn from reading a book, right? You earn the experience of having read the book. Like, I think that we're, with the recent game generation, like the PS3 and 360 kind of generation, we've become a bit sidetracked and obsessed over these externalities. So it's like, you know, a game's not worthwhile unless it's counting my progress towards stuff that, you know, in the end don't mean anything other than bragging rights amongst, you know, certain subcultures, if you're like one of those Chivo people who compete about such things. Most people, it's kind of like, what? I got what?
Exactly.
But, like, I think, like, if the game itself is not fun and you're not getting stuff out of playing the game moment to moment, the game has failed. Yeah. And, you know, that's fine. Don't Starve can fail for some people. It will. Like, because nothing appeals to everybody. But if the only thing that would make you play Don't Starve is that you get an achievement for chopping down X number of beefalo or whatever, I don't think you should play the game. It's not the game for you. Like, you have to enjoy what you're doing as you're doing it, or it's not worth doing. Because it's entertainment, right? Like, it's games. It's not.
Well, you know, I think that it's kind of like beaten into people that achievement should be in every game, because every major AAA does it. But again, a lot of these achievements aren't even achievements. Again, they're just like starting the game. You start game.
I've put those achievements into games before as a programmer. for the both Shank games, I think you got an achievement for beating every level. And I mean, like, we were using that internally as like a really rudimentary, like, stats tracking thing to see how far people were getting into the game. But that's for us, not for the players, right? Like, it's kind of sad, I think, really. I mean, like, Xbox Live Arcade, and actually Xbox in general, I think, actually, as a platform requirement, requires you to have a certain number of achievements.
Yeah, that's what I heard, too, a few years ago.
Yeah, like, you have to have a leaderboard, for example, if you're an XBLA game. Not every game needs a leaderboard, but it's one of their platform requirements, because they're trying to push, like, gold accounts or whatever. And I think, like, you know, Jonathan Blow has gone on and on about this in more detail than I can say, but it's really just, like, this, it's a bit off-putting, I think, if you want games to progress as a medium and as an art form and whatnot, to have this kind of, like, external one-size-fits-all kind of design mentality enforced upon you. So, you know, that's why Don't Starve doesn't have achievements.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that, especially with, like, games like Bioshock or just general AAA development games, where the only achievements that are in the game are, you know, you beat level 2 or you got through the tutorial. Yay!
Well, like, Bioshock, like, you shoot 5 guys with a shotgun, and a little pop-up shows up and says, oh, you're, you know, 5% further along to get the shotgun achievement. I'm like, really? Aren't you undermining the whole story thing you're trying to build up? And aren't you, like, that's totally breaking immersion for me right now. And I don't know. And actually, in PS3 land, there's no way to turn that stuff off either. So, yeah, it's a strange situation.
Now, yeah, I always thought that it would be a cool system if you could use that gamer score to, I don't know, buy things like wallpapers or skins or something like that. That would be cool. And the new PlayStation stuff, they're thinking about doing something like that with their new system. I think that'd be really cool. But at the moment in time, again, we just said, it's just bragging rights. And does anyone really care about, you know, those numbers? Not really, except for those super hardcores that people shun anyways.
Yeah, well, you know, it's got their thing, right? But maybe kids like it. I don't know. I'm an old man, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've never heard someone try to win an argument that way. It's like, well, your argument is invalid because I have 10,000, 100,000 gamer score.
I would say the only two games I really like the achievement system for, I would say one would be like the Demon's Souls, Dark Souls, you know, like the super difficult games, like the ones where, you know, being a level is in fact an actual achievement because of the difficulty of the game. And the other one, I think my favorite though would be the Binding of Isaac for their achievement system, because I remember reading an article how he didn't like achievements the same way as we talk about how when they're completely extrinsic rewards. So what he decided to do was he made it so that they would give you stuff for the actual play in the game. It would make it more interesting on that regard. Now, I think it really did add a lot to the game, because each achievement you basically got in the game basically fundamentally altered the game in some aspect. Sometimes, like, a small way. Other times, you know, this raggle, you know, we're going to make the game harder type way.
Right, right. I think, like that... That's a pretty good philosophy in general. I mean, like, if you can integrate something into the actual gameplay design of a game, it's way better than if you just kind of tack it on. So, like, you know, multiplayer is a good example of that. A lot of games, like, you know, like, you buy, like, Call of Duty, and it has a single player and a multiplayer, and you're like, well, not really. you know, like, one is there just to fulfill the requirements. And everyone can see through that. But like other games, like, you know, the achievements in Binding of Isaac, if they are integral to the experience and they are a part of the game that has been considered by the designer, and they would actually argue to keep it if they had the option to not keep it, then I think that that's just better for gamers. That's better for people making games and keeping their sanity while they're doing such in general.
Yeah, I remember reading a piece by the guys who did Spec Ops The Line about just how much he just opposed the idea of multiplayer for the game. Mm-hmm. And I think his quote was, he called it like a cancerous tumor of the game.
They had a design vision for Spec Ops that would be completely undercut by multiplayer.
Yeah, if you think about it now, if you play the game, it definitely does. If you, I mean, all it does is kind of feeds into what's required. And I guess it's also its own way, kind of like its marketing thing, because it's trying to, you know, play up to that demographic for that particular reason, to give them that surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know Ken and I, we actually tried playing the co-op of the game.
Oh my god.
And had so much trouble. And yet it just went, like, after you play Spec Ops, which we're definitely not going to spoil on this chat, but, like, when you play that game, it just goes down such an interesting hole that, you know, everything that really has become a standard of the military shoot just goes against what they are trying to do.
Right.
By the way, that co-op is atrocious. That's one of my worst experiences.
I didn't even play that co-op.
Well, try it sometime. Cry some tears.
It was fun to play co-op, but you knew that this was not what they, you know, spent a lot of time on. This was probably like a rush job, you know, just throw in to make the publisher happy.
Yeah, I found that with, what's the game? Drake's Fortune, the second one, I believe. Like, the co-op was kind of, what? why is this here? This isn't what you were seeking to do.
Yeah, it's kind of like Dead Space has multiplayer. I'm like, why does it have multiplayer? But, yeah.
Because producer reasons.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah.
Okay. I just remember one question that I had. One of the general complaints that I, when I was writing my analysis for Don't Starve, that I had, was that once you basically become very knowledgeable in the game, once you start talking about being an expert, the beginning of the game starts to become very routine. And how it really feels like there's only, like, a few optimum ways of going through, like, you know, staying near a beefalo herd or being near a pigman. Now, I know you guys just released, I think it was a hot fix that added the option for, you know, a default plus variant to the game.
Yep.
I was just wondering, what are your thoughts on that type of issue? Like, are you guys going to do anything else to maybe alter the beginning for hardcore players, or do you think that it's going to basically remain the way it is?
I wouldn't really say anything will ever remain the way it is in Don't Starve, just because we, like, you know, shifting sands, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely something that came up in a lot of reviews, and a lot of, like, people in the community talking about, like, you know, I like the game, but, you know, I've played 8 hours of it so far, and when I die and I restart and I have to collect twigs and grass for a half hour before I can actually get to the part of the game that I'm interested in, it's a bit of a drag. So we put in Default Plus, which, you know, it basically just kind of bootstraps your economy. It gives you a couple of stacks of the basic materials so that you can kind of pick it all up and then go off adventuring and hopefully get up to that mid-tier stuff pretty quickly. I would say that, you know, like, that's probably not the final version of that. It's had an okay reception. I think people appreciate it for being there. We may tweak the loadout for that. We may, as the game gets super like longer and whatnot, we may have to have like default plus plus where you get like that plus some more stuff because, you know, you don't want to spend 20 hours building a base first. But yeah, like that's something that just the fact that we were able to, like, as reviews are coming in, and are still coming in, we are able to actually react to some of those and improve the game, for everybody basically, was awesome. And that's just, you can only do that in PC games. Consoles, it costs you like $10,000 or so to patch, a live console game, cause it has to go through QA again, be recertified. We are the publisher. I can press a button and push a new build onto Steam. And, you know, there's kind of great danger in that, you know, I could really screw things up if I'm not careful. And I really hope I don't. But, it allows us to kind of, you know, be proactive and really respond to the community and fix things that are broken.
One other question. I was reading, I forget where I read this from, but people were talking about like the general attitude, the general strategy of Don't Starve. And one thing that a lot of people were saying was about how once you reach that point of stability, that the game does become somewhat static in terms of your general strategy. Do you see at some point more ways of upsetting that? Do you think that the point of Don't Starve is become stable, or do you think it's generally about, you know, always hanging on by the skin of your teeth kind of deal?
It's a really interesting question, and I think that's kind of the central design problem of a survival game. I mean, there aren't a lot of survival games out there, really. I mean, Minecraft does kind of a little bit of it, but not a ton, really. And then there's like Unreal World. I think there's some Minecraft mods that I've heard of that kind of push Minecraft more in the direction of a survival game. But, like, yeah, like that question of, like, you know, if you can become stable, and then stay stable through maintenance, some people will find that to be a super compelling experience, right? Because it's like, that's my payoff. I have mastered this game, and now I can sit in my hut and survey the surroundings and basically do nothing. Other people find that the most boring thing in the world, and you'll never get those people to agree. Like, you know, like, we'll send the Deer Clops to go smash their stuff, and some people go like, yeah, that's awesome, now I'm back to nothing again, and I can try to survive. Others will rage quit, flip the table, like, I can't believe you betrayed me and broke my base. So I think, like, I have not answered that question yet. I don't know what the long-term best thing to do there is, other than maybe to give people the option, in the world gen parameters, or to treat survival more as the hub area of the game and put like the really challenging stuff for people who really are gluttons for punishment and want to hang on by the skin of their teeth, like put that in kind of the offshoot worlds like adventure mode or the caves or the moon or whatever we do next, right? But yeah, that's I think that's the central design problem for survival games.
Yeah, I think with Don't Starve, when you create the survival mode, it is a random map, but it is a set area for the player to explore. And I think because of that, I think just from my personal experience, when you have like a set place, it does become somewhat annoying when you do have to pick up and move, because there are only a few, I guess, quote unquote, habitable areas. Like, as we talked about earlier, there is a general strategy to be near a beefalo or be near a pigman community just for, you know, the materials you get from them and general safetiness.
Right.
But if, like, with Minecraft, when you load up a new world, that world is, you know, enormous. So if you want, you know, pick yourself up and you move to another continent, there's, you know, this whole new geography, whole new place to explore. And I think that's where it's a little bit more accepting, you know, to, you know, tearing down and just start from scratch again.
Yeah, I think, like, Minecraft is a very, I mean, there are some surface similarities, and we're definitely influenced by Minecraft. I mean, like, I think I've described Don't Starve as, like, the first day of Minecraft as a game. You know, like, that feeling that you get, you know, that first night where the creepers come and you're hiding in your hole, like, that emotion, that emotional response in the player was something that I really wanted to replicate and write a bit bigger than they do, because you kind of lose that in Minecraft after you've got, like, your tower into the sky where you live, with gardening on the top or whatever you're doing. But I think, like, Minecraft is beyond that. It's a very different game in that Minecraft is more about building, and the world of Minecraft isn't that interesting. Like, it's interesting. Don't get me wrong. I like Minecraft, but there's not a lot in the world. Like, it's there's blocks, and then there's some mobs that kind of have some basic behaviors and don't do that much beyond them. There's not a lot of interlocking systems. It's more of a Lego set.
Yeah.
In that respect. And that's great. I mean, it's a very interesting thing. And you see great things like, you know, the Redmine community and all that, or Redstone, sorry, Redmine's our bug tracker. The Redstone community. And it's a really good outlet for player creativity, but it's not so much a systems game, which is what we were trying to go for with Don't Starve. And we have some degrees of success and we could do better in a lot of other areas, but like, yes, you can go across the world in Minecraft, but what do you really find there? You find more of the same, I think.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I said in my analysis, that this isn't so much a knock against Don't Starve, but just my own personal preference, is that I'm not a huge sandbox-type gamer. I like having, you know, some kind of goal or something to build towards, or just something to do that's not just me, you know, just doing whatever I want for, you know, 20 hours at a time. Type deal.
Yeah, I think like that was definitely something that we saw in a lot of the beta feedback. Like, you know, some people really like that. Like, I can just noodle around in here and it's great and I don't have to worry about anything that I don't want to do. Whereas other people, you know, they just need a goal of some kind. And, you know, we're very hesitant to give the player direct goals because we don't really want to direct the player behavior to that degree. But I think, like, you know, something like adventure mode where the goal is get to the end of adventure mode. that's high level enough that, you know, what you do to get there is kind of up to you, but it does give, at least some players who really like goals, something to kind of focus upon.
All right. So I guess this is the last question I have for Don't Starve. I know we talked about how there's a lot of things that you don't want to reveal about Don't Starve because of the fact that you don't want to overpromise for it. Mm-hmm. So my question to you is, what is, like, as the developer, lead developer for, what is your, like, eye in the sky, you know, dream content that you would like to see at for Don't Starve at some point, if you could have one?
If I could have anything. I want lots of stuff in the world. Like, lots of interesting stuff. Like, there's stuff in the world now, but it doesn't interlock quite enough. Like, you can't, like, I think the caves will help in that you'll go down to the caves, you'll get materials that you can't get otherwise, you'll bring stuff back, and now you can decorate your base with, like, snurtle shells or whatever. And you can build, like, you know, explosive traps and things like that. I think just more of that. I mean, like, one of the most interesting games, I think, in games right now, is Dwarf Fortress. And that game is really cool because there's so much stuff in there and it's so hard to figure out and there's probably stuff in there that no one's ever seen, right? Because it's so hard to get to. But yeah, like if the closer we get towards that, and we are very far from that, I think that the more interesting the game will be. So, you know, like some kind of like fancier building stuff, mechanical devices that you can power and tune and that kind of thing. Like that kind of stuff would be interesting. More places to go. I kind of want to see Wilson go to the moon.
Nice.
You know, like old timey moon travel, like in that to the moon movie.
To the moon, the movie. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's going to have a face and everything.
Right. Yeah. It's so cool. Like the Smashing Pumpkins video, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, like aesthetically, that's perfect. You know, bottom of the sea diving suit kind of place. Like there are other places that we can go that are very different from what we have now. And would be interesting. And there'd be new stuff that you can do and new mechanics that you can have. The first of which though is the mines. It's not that different. And we can wrap, like we're getting walls and walls are turning out to be kind of hard given our art style. So hopefully that'll work.
Well, the one benefit of the art style is anything in silent film would work. For the most part, because you're right, to the moon is perfect because it is that era, so it would fit that style because it is reminiscent of German Expressionism too.
Yeah, well, I think it's something I don't know if we'll ever actually go there, but it's definitely in the pot. We have this like list of things that the team all contributed to, and it's like things that we could do, you know, someday, because we have, you know, at least 6 more months, or I guess at this point 5.5 more months of content to fill out. So we got to come up with some ideas, and we have a pretty big list, and to the moon is on there. But, you know, I'm pulling for it, but I don't know if the rest of the team is.
Well, yeah, And with the game too, I think the big part and what I find enjoyable about Don't Starve is the aha moments. And that's a big thing in psychology. I have actually, I know a professor that's studying the aha moment. And I think that is, if you can create more items that do that and create the kind of investments to the player, I think that would be great. I think that anything that would do would be great.
Yeah, I saw a talk by Raph Koster at GDC last year and his theory of fun, which is like he has a very learning-based theory of fun. So like in his opinion, what fun, and I'm probably misrepresenting this, but what fun is when you manage to learn something new, and it's like the brain rewarding itself for being plastic, right? So I think that our game at least attempts to fit into that definition of fun very closely. And you know, like when people figure out, like, and I've seen this in our little study groups and whatnot, when people figure out that they can, you know, they see a rabbit, and they're like, I want to eat that rabbit because I'm hungry and rabbits are edible, damn it. And they go and they try to hit it and it runs away and it's very frustrating. But then they see that, oh, I can trap and I can build a trap and the rabbit will surely go into my trap. And they build the trap and they put it down. They watch the rabbit ignore the trap and they're like, oh, so frustrating. But then they're like, what are rabbits like? Carrots. And then they put a carrot in the trap and the game actually lets them do that. And then the rabbit goes into the trap and then they eat the rabbit. I think that is that whole loop, right? Where it's like, the game is presenting a challenge. It's not an explicit, like, you will get 5 points for trapping this rabbit and an Steam achievement will pop up. But it's like, you know, it's kind of just follows naturally from the fiction, from the setting that we provided, that's something that you want to do. And you can do it, in a way that is semi-obvious if you think through it logically, and it all kind of works and comes together. I think that's like the key Don't Starve moment. And we just need to make more of that.
Right.
Yeah, I think that type of learning, I think, has been somewhat difficult translating to video games because, as you said, with having like the real world logic of, you know, trap, carrot, rabbit, a lot of video games either don't think that far or they rely on, you know, game physics or game logic. So it becomes somewhat hard to, I guess, show these types of lessons and teach the player to do these types of things traditionally in most video games.
Yeah, and I think that, like, you know, by keeping our game very, it's rather abstract. Like, it's not a 3D world that you're walking through and it's super realistic. It's like little cardboard cutout men running around and very broad caricatures of actions and objects. And like, by keeping it at kind of that high level, then it's a lot easier to think in those terms than if we were like a really, you know, grim, dark, super realistic, Unreal 3 engine game where, you know, making that rabbit trap would have been, you know, 3 weeks of developer time.
And going back to what you were just talking about with hoping to add, like, more interconnected content, that was one of the things that I also expressed in my analysis, because it kind of felt, well, I think one of the issues I have is that if you don't get lucky with the world generation or you miss an important item, that can basically, you know, cut out an entire part of the technology tree. So hopefully, as you say, if you can add more connected to it, you can sort of, you know, get around the issue because there'll be so much that you can build, it pretty much keeps your options very open and viable.
Yeah, and like I think, like, you know, like I've seen this happen as we've been developing, like in the early days when it was like, you know, Wilson and a pig and some rabbits, and that was kind of all that was in the game. You're damn well going to see that every time you play because that's all we got, you know. But then as we add more things, we can hold things back. Like, you know, maybe you don't need a pig king. How can you deal without having a pig king? Or maybe there's no tall birds in this world or whatever. There's at some point, and I don't think we're quite there yet, but we're almost. At some point, you have enough content that you don't have to show everything. And as soon as you can do that, then the game is different every time you play. And you get this sense of there being a lot more there than there necessarily is because you can't quantify it through just one playthrough. Yeah. So I think that's definitely a goal for us.
Right. Yeah, and that definitely sounds like a good goal too. Because once it gets to the point where it's that big that you really can't see everything in one play, it makes it less, I guess, damning if, you know, if you, for some reason, let's say in a one world, there are no trees or there's no,
flowers.
Okay, yeah, let's go with flowers. And there's no flowers, so you can't build the wreath for your hair that restores sanity at the beginning. Then it's like, instead of saying, oh, great, it's not there, now what am I going to do? Now it's like, okay, it's not there, what else can I use? Oh, wait, there's, you know, this over here that can also restore sanity. Let me experiment with that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, like, you have to seek to eliminate bottlenecks. In terms of, like, there is a thing in the game that can only be overcome with one particular strategy. Like, if as soon as you have that, then you have to have that all the time, and you have to find that every time, or the game kind of breaks down. So the more, like, routes around that or alternate strategies that you can give to defeat that, the better.
All right. So I think with that, we're going to wrap up our cast. It was great having you on, Kevin.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And I would like to, of course, thank Kevin and Ken for being on. This was definitely a great chat about Don't Starve. I'm really interested to see what you guys are going to come up with within the next 5.5 months.
Yeah, me too. It's going to be an interesting ride.
All right. And for those of you listening, as always, I like to end the cast with saying that if you are interested in coming on for a cast or even just writing a piece for the site, feel free to send us an email. You'll see the link on our front page under Submissions Wanted. And with that, thank you for listening to the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.